Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money, major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? March has never changed anything.
Kelvin Krushank Odape. My African dream is the KJOL since 2020. I saw a moving plane passing by and something told me to build a plane. So
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he would.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. It's amazing. But everything in this world changes except God's basic laws. And His laws are unchangeable. They serve as an infallible guide to meet every crisis, every change in life. If we can rise sufficiently out of the rut into which any situation or circumstance has pushed us and apply the same basic laws to our particular situation as preceding generations have used, we'll find the same result. God's laws never change. Everything in this world changes except God's basic laws. For example, as a man thinketh, so is he. An understanding heart is the most precious of earthly possessions. Man is master of his mind, and hence master of all circumstances. These laws have always been basic. They're just as true now as 2,000 years ago, or even 5,000 years ago. God never abandons us, even though, as the 23rd Psalm so clearly assures us, we may walk in the valley of death. He provides the strength He knows is necessary for us whenever we need it. Such are fundamental laws which apply to every situation, terrifying or not. Everything in life has a purpose. We may wonder sometimes what purpose some misfortune can have, but every event has its role in the growth of the human soul. Sometimes the purpose is not revealed for years, or if we fail to exert the strength God gave us, perhaps is never known to us during our passage on earth. But nevertheless, everything that happens to each of us has its share in the growth of our soul. No matter how unpleasant any situation may appear, how far removed at first sight from any seeming possibility for good, this fact remains. What happens to each of us is part of the Creator's divine plan, and how we react is the privilege which God has given us. The way we react represents the freedom extended to each of us by God. No intelligent human can fail to take hope, watching the intricate mechanism of life, with each minute's experience fitting perfectly into the overall life pattern. A bee buzzes as her path crosses a little too closely our own. A bird chirps a cheery call to its mate. A spider spins its web. These phenomena, in fact, everything in life, have their particular reasons. When it rains in our lives, it is because we need the rain in order to enjoy the sunshine and reap rich harvests. The way we meet all these phenomena, the way we master life, is our liberty of choice, mercifully granted by the Creator. The effect of every cause depends upon our reaction. Our soul grows as we overcome the trials and appreciate life's beauties and happy interludes. Oh yes, we can give vent to hatred and intolerance or despair, or we can deny these emotions which blind us to love and beauty and truth. And then we may acquire understanding, instead of always seeking to have others understand us. No man can antedate his experience or guess what faculty or feeling a new object shall unlock, any more than he can draw today the face of a person he shall see tomorrow for the first time. So wrote Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it's true, we're constantly learning new lessons. Often we find that what we have learned is that which we have failed to appreciate and to understand. Maturity often comes too late for us to profit by the lessons we should have learned earlier, but never too late for each of us to try to pass on to those who follow the lessons we finally understand. Life is a process of continual change and development as well as growth. But God's laws are never changing. To be happy, to make our lives satisfying, we must be flexible enough in mind and body and consciousness to accept changes when they come. Don't stubbornly resist all changes in your life and affairs. Make these changes yield the harvest of good that potentially lies in each one of us. This may be difficult, but let me tell you, you can do it if you will. You, as a matter of fact, and only you, can determine whether you are to be bowed down, crushed, steamrollered by the events of life, or overcome them and come out triumphant, a happy individual. That's your right if you apply God's basic laws. No matter how drastic changes in your life may seem, in your occupation, your place or mode of living, in your surrounding or associations or activities, or anything that concerns you, good is in this change for you. If you search hard enough to find it and accept it and make it your own by your reaction, by your adaptation to this change, scenes and times and circumstances all come and go. But God is eternal and unchanging, and so is his law. His good is unfailing. What each of us needs is the deep personal conviction that this good exists in every circumstance. Then, no matter what may come, we can remain poised and serene, free from fear. When we are aware of and exercise the tremendous power of our minds to dominate circumstances, overcome obstacles and snags, a peaceful, contented, and satisfying life is within our grasp. You know, actually, we're really not alive except when fighting the perils that threaten the mind and soul. Life is a challenge, a wonderful challenge, a wonderful adventure. When there is no struggle, life degenerates into vegetable-like existence, inert, torpid, and decadent. It is the challenge of peril, physical, mental, or spiritual, that makes life vigorous and can make it triumphant. There are inevitable moments of our lives when a storm is as certain and as necessary as storms in the skies. There are other moments in which life's elements combine to give us a serene, perfect moment, when sun and temperature make the day electrically beautiful. We cannot prevent these extreme highs and lows that temper our soul, make them grow. We can only do our best and never relax our faith in God's mercy. Whatever experiences we meet on life's course, in order for our minds and souls to attain maximum growth, we must always hold firmly in mind life's basic analysis. And what is this? Well, life is composed of two parts. Keep this always in mind. Life is composed of two parts. The first part, beyond our individual control. Events, circumstances, situations, problems. The second part, the part we can control, our reaction. The experiences we cannot control in no way prevent or limit our choice of reaction to these same experiences. Thus, in the end, our reactions, the second part of life, is much more important than any experience or situation or problem. Imagine an ocean dotted with coral islands, some small and some large, and washed by rising and outgoing tides. There you see a graphic illustration of our lives. The islands are the experiences we cannot avoid, the situations which sweep us away with joy or with sorrow, with happiness or anxiety. Before any man's life story is fully written, he must move from many of these coral islands to others. We cannot choose our individual islands of experience. But like the tide that flows against them, we can roll triumphantly over the coral rock, or we can break in many pieces. The way we move from one island of experience to another is ours to choose. Destiny provides the experiences we meet. We exert our own reactions. Do we wonder why life appears difficult at times? Do we wonder why there exists such reckless disregard for God's laws? Do we wonder why what seems evil appears to rage rampant in the world? We need not and should not be disheartened. There is no living thing in the world, plant or tree, fish or fowl, protoplasm or human being, without a place, a particular place, in the Creator's perfect plan. It is not necessary for each big or little entity endowed with life to be conscious of its own mission. It is sufficient to know there is no life, no spark of life without a purpose, no death without its role in the drama of life. Study the physical body. The answers to life's spiritual and intellectual cycles are clearly shown each day for our enlightenment. The body's marvels show how clearly sorrow and joy, pain and pleasure transform into part of a picture of growth. We begin our life in strife and struggle as we are born, and these conflicts continue until physical death. So sometimes you may feel that your load in life is too heavy for you to carry, that it is weightier than your strength and endurance can bear. Readjust your thinking. The strange thing about your load is it doesn't really bear down on your shoulders. It actually lifts you upwards. Imagine a load which lifts you upward. The life without a load is a life that goes down in defeat. Hear the fable of the small boy who read the story of Atlas, the titan who carried the world on his shoulders. The little boy imagined at first that Atlas must have been almost crushed under the weight of the world. But later the youngster began to think in terms of Atlas's enormous strength. Only then did he begin to see that heavy loads must be wings that lift instead of crushing burdens. The small boy perhaps did not realize it, but growth was taking place within him. Soon the conscious physical reaction of the boy to his thought processes had him lifting the biggest stones he could find and carry. He tugged at paving stones and heavy wooden blocks, simply to pit his strength against them. And just like the boy, as we go through life, we learn no one can be really happy unless he carries a load. A human being fully lives only as he lifts. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
The only two things in life that make it worth living is guitars tuned good and firm feeling women. I don't need my name in the marquee lights. I got my song and I got you with me tonight. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs, Blueberry's train songs, and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans and go away. This coat and tie is choking me, and in your high society you cry all day. We've been so busy keeping up with the Joneses, four-car garage, and we're still building on it. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs, Newberry's train songs, and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Willie and Waylon and boy. This successful life we're living's got us feuding like the Hatfields and the Coys. Between the Hank Williams Payne song, Jerry Jeff train songs, and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, there ain't nobody feeling no pain.
All right, it's time for Tiny Town time. We do if anything, the primary topic that we touch on every day, and we've been doing it for 12 days now, is actually over 12 days, but we've got our 12th town, And thanks for Warren from Wake Up New Orleans, New Orleans Wake Up. He made me aware of this town yesterday. So we're going to feature it today. Pennytown, that's one word, P-E-N-N-Y, Pennytown, T-O-W-N. One word, though. Pennytown, Missouri. All right, Pennytown, Missouri, and it was founded by Joseph Penny, also known as Joe Penny. And let's go online where we can read about it. Pennytown, is in an unincorporated area of Saline County, Missouri, here in the United States. Historically, it was the largest African American community in central Missouri. Joe Penny, a former slave from Kentucky, started what would become Pennytown in March of 1871 when he purchased 8 acres of land for $160. Which in $23, it'll be a little over $3,000. Anyway, let's see. 10 more purchases by black families followed during the 1870s, and by 1880, black farmers owned more than one-third of the land in the Salt Fork Township. Historically, the population consisted of former slaves and their descendants. Pennytown's peak population was 1,000 people. The final birth in the community occurred in 1944. Around that period, due to lowering economic prospects, many families began to move to Marshall, Missouri. As time passed, more and more of the buildings were raised. As of 2014, the only remaining building is the former what they call Pennytown. It is the Free Will Baptist Church of Pennytown. All right, so we don't know if anybody's living at that church. You see, they do have a Facebook friend page, Friends of Pennytown. And they do post on their page. And let me see. Let's go to their website. No direct phone number, but they do have plenty of contacts, so I'll come back to them later. All right, so that's our feature town for today, number 12. And let's see, some of the things I wanted to there's some common denominators that I've noticed. And this, I'm putting this information out here for people who you might want to found your own town. You might want to start your own town. So let me share with you some of the common denominators that I have noticed. And here we go. Okay. Number one, you got to find some land. Ideally 1 acre, but it doesn't have to be an acre. I think I've run across something that was less than an acre. But you got to find some land. Number two, you need to choose a legal and a business model. Those are two. I'm putting them, saying them as one, but they're really two common denominators. And you need to, I would also have a safety model, a place where your community, in this case a town or a village, have a location and safety model. Okay. Getting the right location, the safety part takes care of itself. And that's what I've noticed about a lot of the little towns that I've personally visited. Okay, other common denominators, all right, once again, if you can't buy land by the acre, for as little as an acre or even below that, you can start a town. All right, we already went to legal and business model. Because some towns were not set up to operate as a business. Most towns are, but many are not. Okay. Now, there are five basic distinctions of what the type of town that you might want to set up or eventually get to, so let's go to them. Number one will be a municipal community, a municipal township. Municipal townships, typically, they're the most expensive type of community to live in because they offer municipal services. Now, you could live in a municipal township that has a low population. And if you live in a municipality that has a low population, okay, cost of living can be very affordable. But most of your major towns have municipal charters, and they offer municipal services. What are municipal services? Water, police, law enforcement, a court system. These are all municipal services. In some locations, power, you know, electricity. You know, those are the businesses. And having a police department is a business. Having a court system is a business. Having a DMV, driver's motor vehicle agency, that is a business. All of those are municipal businesses. They're all municipal businesses, you know. The permits department is a municipal service. It is a business. That's how these towns with a municipal charter, that's their business model, offering municipal services, and that's how the city generates money. All right. And now in return, okay, because you're paying that through your tax dollars, if you got a disturbance at your home, you can call the police. That's part of the, you know, you pay the taxes for this, and here's what the city gives you back in return. Municipal services, like you got access to water, you got access to power. In many cases, you have electrical utility power. You have somebody cleans those roads up, cleans the streets. Trash service, recyclable service, all of these are municipal services. Okay, now, typically they also have a mayor's office. Some places have a city manager, that he runs the city. And or alderman or councilman service. All of those are part of a town or community. Now, with all that said, that stuff's expensive. All right, however, some people can, and they get it mostly through your property taxes. So, and they offer typically the larger the town, the more comfort and convenience is, because they might have a bus line. Now, the bus line might be a municipal service, but these days a lot of times it's a private company that offers, you know, bus, or in some cases metro service, which is subway. All right, the next model will be unincorporated. Unincorporated areas are typically less expensive to live in than incorporated areas, which are the municipal townships, because they don't have a mayor, they don't have a city council, there's no social services. You're responsible for your trash and recycling. Nobody's going to come by and pick it up. So you also have more freedom in these places, and like I said, the cost of living is the less expensive. However, with that said, in an unincorporated township, okay, a lot of it falls back on you. You're responsible for your trash, you know, safety and all this other type of stuff. Now, I'm giving you the fundamentals here today because there's some combinations of this too. Some people might have an incorporated area, but they might subcontract with a neighboring city or town that does have a municipal police force that do patrols. So I'm just giving you the bare bones, purest definition or examples, but they can be mixed up too. Let's see. The next one, you can have a closed township. You want it closed. And you can look this up online. Look up closed townships. They exist, and they're global. There's also close to the closed townships, private townships. Now, we mentioned one the other day, last week, Venice Beach, Maryland. Venice Beach, Maryland is a township that sits on 13 acres of land. All right? And for all practical purposes, it's a combination of a closed township and private township. 50 families make use of, some of them live there, some of them visit there, or a combination of the two. But it's for family members. It's, I think, going in its fourth generation. It's for family members. The founders of Venice Beach, Maryland, they put it together for families. So 50 families make use of Venice Beach, Maryland, which happens to be a de facto black township. All right? Interesting, you never hear about nobody getting killed there or having police troubles there. That's where the action is. If you can't get law and order or protection or wherever you live at now in a larger community, find yourself, like I said, they didn't start with 40 acres, 13 acres. All right. Now, another example would be, let me go to my next one. The next one's going to be a combination of some elements here. A company town, Hershey, Pennsylvania, the town that was built on a chocolate candy bar, is a company town. Another one would be, and I would say, Tavistock, New Jersey, which is, I would say it's a combination of a closed town, a private town, and a company town, because the founders of Tavistock, New Jersey, they only have three households there, and they have 9 registered voters. But they have membership into the town of 400-plus, because they have a country club. That this all springs out of a country club. Tavistock. Hey, man, who wants to play golf on Sunday? And there's a private membership, all right? And in order to get private membership, steps one and two, and actually they're both one and the same, is you need to get a letter of recommendation from two members in good standing. That's hurdle number one. Once again, this is a de facto closed, private, and company town. The company part of it is the revenue is coming from their country club. All right, where this whole thing started. So they're bringing in revenue through their country club, which has initiation fees. After you, let's say you get those two letters of recommendation from people in good standing. All right, so you can't look up in the yellow pages and join this township. Then the next thing is you need to have a $25,000 initiation fee. Mar-a-Lago, where President Trump resides, the membership for that community is $100,000 to $200,000. That's a one-time fee. Now, getting back to Tavistock, then there's $4,000. Depends on what type of membership that you want. You have to pay $4,000 a year or $4,000 plus. They probably have some memberships a little lower than that, whatever. But anyway, Tavistock, New Jersey, is a combination of a municipality. Everything we just named was a municipality, not unincorporated, was a municipality. They have registered voters there for in that town. They have a country club that really controls the whole thing. But that's the way it is. And I'm putting out information that basically anybody can access. All right, now. Another common denominator that I've noticed is a company town can be in two flavors. It can be as an individual owner, like Milton Hershey, when he established Hershey, Pennsylvania, the town that was built upon chocolate candy bars, he was the sole owner of the town. And there are other company towns that are owned by companies just like that, by one solo company or person. Now, I also see a distinction with what I call company business model number two. And this can be seen in the Amish and Mennonite communities where, because Amish families to a high degree, they're entrepreneurial families. They have a family business, or in many cases, multiple businesses. The husband, his side of the business, him and the son's side of the business, I'm just making this real plain, is they could be builders. They build tiny houses. They build regular-sized houses. They build barns. They build fences, stuff like that. The father teaches his son and or daughter the building trade, how to build. Not subcontract out, but how to build. Because they go to grades 1 through 8. Then what do they do after 8th grade? Then they learn the family business. Now, in the Amish community, and I've had a person on this, she was raised Amish. But we got to get, I'm going to have to go, because you're not going to get them on with a phone call. I was very fortunate for the one call that I got on this. We got it somewhere in our archives. But I'm going to have, and you, whoever you are, I'm going to have to go out and make friends within the Amish community and then build some social capital and then go but their fam the the way they're structured, for the most part, are the entrepreneurial-based, most of this you see that were married, they had a family business, or a restaurant. Let's call them mom, pa, kettle for the moment. And, you know, they got, you know, dad handles these businesses, which are part of the family business. And you know what? Actually, Amish families, to a high degree, are de facto industries. I'm just talking about one single household. One single household. All right, so they get together with other Amish families, and they do one of two things. Collectively do a farmer's market, or they'll collectively get together and buy a number of acres of land and establish their own township. And really, that's the basis, not with all townships, but with many townships that Western people are familiar with. Towns basically are owned by individual people. And it's the merchants. Now, some of these older towns like New York City, Houston, with just two people, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Illinois, okay, when it comes down to when all the smoke clears, you have individual families that, no wonder you can do all that marching and protesting that you want to do. But the real power comes behind, and that's why I love the Amish and the Hutterite and the Mennonite communities, because if you study what they do and then you study even the black townships, the people who started these and a lot of these people didn't start these townships as an entrepreneurial venture, but many did. But go online and look up Amish community map or Mennonite community or townships map. So what they do is, like I say, they're raised to be entrepreneurs. They're raised to not depend on government. You know, you don't see, and a lot of these Amish families are knocking down $5, $10, $15, $20 million a year. We're talking about per household. Not all of them. Not all of them, but quite a few. So they'll set up a township, okay, and it's typically a group of other entrepreneurs. Now, historically, you have had black families, particularly coming out of the Civil War, actually some before the Civil War, during the Civil War, and then after the Civil War for like the first 50 or 60 years, and some of them were set up by black entrepreneurs who were former slaves, and some of those towns over 100 years old still exist to this day. Okay. Now, Joe Penny, because I highlight today for a tiny town, is Pennytown, Missouri, which was brought to my attention yesterday. All right. 24 hours ago, I didn't know about Pennytown. But it was started by Joseph Penny, also known as Joe Penny. And Joe Penny, a former slave from Kentucky, I imagine, because I haven't found too much written about him, but the little bit I've found so far, I imagine, number one, he wanted a town or a community which was a safe place to live, number one. Number two, the church is still standing there, so they wanted a safe place to worship. Number three, because they got up to a population of 1,000, and more than likely it was an agricultural society or community, they wanted a safe place to conduct commerce. All right? So, yeah, business model on that, Comedy Town 2 is just a combination of all those. Now, let's see. What else do we have here? Let me release my page. So these are, and what Joe Penny did, it's something that, if you want to do it, it's not for everybody, it's something that, okay, Joe went out and bought 8 acres of land. Okay, that's something that if you can't do it alone, you can get together with a family member or a friend and pull that off. Oh, let me add other thing is, here are the common denominators. Typically, they will put together a school, a faith-based meeting place, which would be the church. They had a water source, which was not municipal water, because they knew how to drill their own wells and whatnot. A food source, instead of going to Whole Foods, they had Whole Foods in their backyard, or they had farms. And I already mentioned they had a central marketplace, something where people can come in the middle of that community, and it could be a farmer's market. Today, we call them downtowns in your large cities and whatnot. But anyway, those are some of the common denominators that I have noticed taking a look at these, what I call tiny towns. All right, so we're up to number 12, and we have them numbered in our archives. So we've just been doing this, almost 2 weeks, but we've done some towns. I mean, we've mentioned other towns as well. Now there is, we'll get back to the black townships in Baltimore County, Maryland, more specifically, because I've been saying tomorrow night. So hopefully tomorrow, Friday, I'll pick one of those and we'll cover that. Now, there was one other town that was brought to my attention yesterday from Warren with New Orleans Wake Up or Wake Up New Orleans. So, Warren, I think you're on the phone here. I found the towns you mentioned, but I think I misspelled one of them, and that's the missing town I didn't get. So, hold, let me get to my studio here. And what I like about these towns, it shows you the resilience of some people and how, actually, to be honest about it, they were big thinkers. I mean, here's this guy, Joe Penny, who was born a slave. But he had the mindset, you know what, I'm going to start me a town. And he did it. Okay, so I don't know, that for me, that's motivation. So thank you, Warren, for that. Warren, I'm trying to get back in my studio here. Now I'm back. So, Warren, I believe that's you. Your mic is open.
Yeah, greetings there, L.A. Now, you always get confused with the show. It's New Orleans Wake Up. So whenever you start
New
saying
Orleans
Wake Up,
New Orleans,
just switch the words around.
Switch it around. New Orleans Wake Up.
Yeah, but look, there's a website, huh?
Okay, give me the website because I'm when with you. I got
the website is called Penny. The website is called PennyTownChurch.org. PennyTownChurch.
You said Kenny, K-E-N-N.
P-E-N-N-Y. PennyTownChurch.org.
All right,
and they're having a homecoming on August 6th 2023, and they have so they have their homecoming. Apparently, they've been having homecomings, and there's a little short film on this website, and you might could try to contact somebody to get them on as a guest on the show, because they have a contact information where you could send, put your query in, and I guess they'll get back with you. Tracy Lawrence is the secretary. Virginia Hudson is the chairperson. It's called Officers of Friends of Pennytown Historic Sites. So you might can get somebody on as a guest.
Okay, that's on my list. You mentioned another town yesterday. I found three creeks, but the town there, I got to get the spelling right. Ramrosch.
Wait, let me get to it. Notes here.
Okay.
I had on some notes here.
It's in Missouri, Ramrosch or something like that. But I need you to spell that out for me.
Let's see here. I got my notes right here. Okay, that town was called Namrash, Namrash, and that was established in 1876.
Namrash,
Namrash.
Namrash, and what state?
Missouri.
Missouri, okay.
The county is Cheriton County.
Okay, let me look it up real quick. Namrash. Right here at Namrash, Missouri. It's Chilton County. Let me find the Wikipedia on it. Namrash, soul. Let me see Wikipedia. Okay. With the county. Okay, let's see, Missouri communities.
I just came across a news story from 2022 called Small Town Remembers Its Forgotten Black History. And you go to, this is what you Google. Google KOMU and the number 8, and then put Namrash next to it and see if you can find that story.
All right, KOMU?
U. Yeah, that's like that's the call numbers for the news station. And then put the number 8 next to it, and then put the word Namrash and see if you come across the same link I have right here.
All right, Nam, okay.
And it's going to be called Small Town Remembers Its Forgotten Black History, Preserves Historic Cemetery for the Future. And it's an article with a little video.
Yeah, Small Town Remembers Its Forgotten Black History, Preserves Historic Cemetery. Man, that's in there. Cemetery for the Future. Okay, the Namrash Cemetery in Dalton is covered by scenes of wilderness. A group of townspeople and others from the neighboring areas came to clean it up on Saturday. Nature's taken course of it over the years. All right. Thank you for this.
Now, I wanted talk to your point about creating small towns. Now, I have a different perspective because I feel that when you look at black communities by default, meaning that these places like Lansing, Michigan, or wherever else where you have Gary, Indiana, and all that, so hold that point. When you start a town, you need infrastructure, access to infrastructure, which means roads, potable water, sewage system, electrical grid, internet access, and all of those things require billions of dollars of investment. Now, when you look at cities that have become de facto all-black cities, like Jackson, Mississippi, we can go on and on. We see that the powers that be purposefully neglect those areas. They neglect them. So when we say we want to create all-black towns following model, then in one sense, we kind of we're making ourselves an automatic target for no investment and support, because you got to go through your local legislature, your county officials. You still have to have seek private investment. So my point is, if black predominant metropolitan areas or urban areas or towns are not getting the support currently, I don't see where creating a new town where everybody owns their plot of land, I don't see where that would make it any better. And when you look at these black towns that were established, many of them before the Civil War, in places like Missouri or Kansas or whatever else, I'm gonna take you something when I finish my point. Just remind me. But anyway, when you look at the towns that were created after slavery, in one sense, what's that expression? Necessity is the mother of invention. There was no plan for black people to be included with white people. So black people didn't have no vision of assimilation. They had no vision of integration. All they knew was that they had to take care of themselves. But now with this over 70 years of desegregation and living in proximity and neighborhoods and so on and so forth with white people, the view of being independent like that has pretty much left our consciousness.
Well, I'll tell you what. Are you familiar with the Freedom Georgia Initiative?
I'm familiar with that, yeah. Based on some news stories, yeah.
Yeah, I interviewed them earlier this year. You might want to contact them and do an interview with them yourself. Because they're doing it from scratch. Because you do have to have, everything you're just talking about, that those are some of the things they're working on. I don't know all their business. Mm-hmm. They gave me like a 90-minute interview. But what I see is but not everybody is cut out to do that. I know that. I'm just putting it out there. I mean, because what I like about these old towns is just like with the Pennytown. But he had to go from zero. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But they got him to 1,000 people at one point.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at it. I see it as an option. It's not an option most people are going to take. Because most people, let's face it, the infrastructure, a lot of reason why a lot of these small towns disappear or shrink in population, some really never, is because when two things, water, municipal water, and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the cities that grew to be big, they're the ones that got stuff like that first.
Now, here go another thing, jobs, work. So people left these small towns because the United States was changing more into an industrial base. Areas were generally agricultural. So the men had to have, find work to support their families and have better opportunities. And you look at some of these towns, these settlements, where at that time it would be different because the population would have been more dense in those areas. But when you go through them now, they're like in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. Like I had a cousin, he's passed over. He was from Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And he was sharing with me when he was alive he went, well, first thing, people, black folk, who had gone up north to where, you know, the jobs were at, Chicago, mm-hmm. Milwaukee, Detroit, all those places, they would come back mostly, you know, different people. Some people would drop in weekly, you know, on weekends or whatever when they can get away. And they would come back with a nice new car, nice mm-hmm. clothes, trinkets on their fingers around their neck. And that served as motivation to, now here's the thing. A lot of blacks left behind acres of land, and in the case of this story, in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, I'm sure in other places, to go north because mm-hmm. they needed money for their family. Now, in the case of this particular cousin, he went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin first, and mm-hmm. he applied, but he didn't get anything there. But somebody told him about Detroit. So, he, mm-hmm. you know, Detroit, he went to Detroit, and he got a job, and he said he, oh, man, it was hell on his hands and fingers. But he mm-hmm. had a wife and small child at the time where he had to send money back. And then he mm-hmm. also, while he was working that job, he also applied. He probably applied at a whole bunch of places. General Motors called him up, and they hired him. Now, when he retired mm-hmm. from General Motors, he was a test driver. I don't know what his first job at GM was. Mm-hmm. And the GM job was paying him such good money that he really didn't need the first job at all. But since the guy hired him, you know, the first one that hired him, he said, well, you know, he gave him about a month, gave him a month's notice. And then he got his wife and his daughter up there. Pleasant Stephens, who's been on this show a few times, he went from Arkansas mm-hmm. to Chicago the same way. He found a job in Chicago. And but now it's 2023. It looks like, all right, because they're living in a lot of these larger cities now, including the city that you live in, New Orleans. It looks like mm-hmm. you may have to look for a smaller community where it's less expensive because New Orleans ain't cheap like it used to be. Anyway, but that's my rant on all that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not against that. I just think that we have to consider the things that the obstacles that are. You see, when you have segregation, I guess the thing about segregation, if we had to find anything positive about it, if anything, was the fact that white people said, y'all have y'all stuff over there. Y'all go over there. Don't come over here about uh-huh. us. All right. So black people, you know, hell, yeah. But now it's as almost as if you ain't going to have nothing. And when you do look at communities where black people make up the majority of the population, again, you see that your politics at the state level and it generally organizes against those black population densities and black population areas in a form of cutting support. And I think Jackson, Mississippi is in Flint, Michigan. Those two are case study. We're dealing with water. Water that you got to drink clean water to live. So you can have your own land and all that, but if you environmentally polluted, or if your water is contaminated and everybody dying, that you know. And so I think that's what we kind of have to consider those things. You see.
That's true.
That you have that.
You're right. Well, all right. Let's take a look at Jackson. I've been to both of those cities too. Jackson and Flint. We got the mayorships in both of those cities, I believe. I know we got it in Jackson.
Yeah. But you see those municipalities, those municipalities need support at the state level. So you have Jackson is a majority black city. They more than likely vote Democrat, but Mississippi is a Republican state. And, you know, even the governor of Mississippi has had a very callous attitude towards Jackson. Now, the capital is Jackson, and he goes to a talk one time and make a comment, some kind of joke regarding him. So my point is, I understand the concept but these white folk is not going to sit back and just let black people create a paradise for themselves, and they don't try to mess it up or make it impossible for you some kind of way. My point is, the situation today is not the same situation after enslavement, because after enslavement, there was no intention to black people in their mind had no vision of assimilating with white people. That was not even – we wanted more than anything else to be left alone, so we can take care of ourselves. See, that's a different mindset than the day where we're looking for acceptance. And even another thing I had is just advertising stuff. You're like, if we don't do it and don't make no big deal about it. But we're gonna have a freedom city, and we're going to have all this, and we're going to have a black Wall Street. And the white folks in that land and say, yeah, sure you are. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Who do you have to go through?
That's true. The mindset has changed. You're right.
But we don't, we're basically what's happening today is we want so much acceptance. We want so much validation from white folk that even when we do stuff in the name of we got to support each other, and we're saying it loud and we broadcast it all on TV, we're really looking for a response about white people, really. But see, the ancestors, they didn't look for all that. They first of all, they had skills. They knew how to grow food for themselves. Yeah. They were skilled people. They were blacksmiths. They were carpenters. They knew how to build every house for themselves. They knew how to they had all of that. So they were actually able to create self-sustained communities. It's a different day. We don't, overall in our population, we don't have those skills of building and construction like we used to have. We don't have that. We just have been working jobs. We've been working jobs for the last 80 years, we all got to work, of course, but we just don't have that. And the Freedom Town, whatever that was called in Georgia when it was announced, I said the mistake they're making is making a big deal about this, publicizing it, and I said at the end point, it's not going to be what you're saying it want to be, because there are a lot of factors that go involved, and that's just kind of like how that. But before I forget, I want to tell you this. There's a book that I have here called The Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. So this is basically what the book is about. When they were putting together the Constitution, what'd you say, L.A.?
No, give me the name of the book again. I'm talking
about it's called The Bone, because there's something here I'm going to tell you about. She got a graft in here. The Bone and Sinew, S-I-N-E-W, of the land, the bone and sinew of the land, America's Forgotten Black Pioneers. And this is basically what the book is about. When the Constitution was being put together, the Northwest Ordinance, that's those states that make up places like Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, and these places, they were not to be slave areas. They were not to be slave areas from the very beginning of the United States. So what you had was black people who were in the slave states, either when they became free or they escaped, they go to this territory, and they create, she has a whole chart here, African-American farming settlements in the Northwest Territory states, 1800 to 1860, and she has Ohio, had 95. Indiana, 92. Illinois, 56. Wisconsin, 31. Michigan, 64. A total of 338. And she has a map where she has them dotted on the map. So the Northwest Territory were these states, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. They were not slave states from the very beginning, because when they were putting together the Constitution, they were meeting, that's what the agreement was, that this territory would not be slave states. So black people who lived in slave states, when they became free or if they escaped, went to this area here and created these farm settlements.
Okay.
So you look, so you're doing this series. This series could carry on for years.
Yeah. I think it's information that people need to know. I didn't know about this when I started this podcast. I was looking for some subject in black history to study up on, and I ran across black townships, mm-hmm. and I've been hooked on it ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you get this book, you'll see in the map, she has the maps dotted with these farm settlements, and then she has a little grid. So if there's a white circle, she says settlement with at least one African-American-owned farm, no larger than 199 acres, with property valued at less than $1,999. One star, if there's one star, is settlement with at least one African-American farmer owning 200 acres or more or worth $2,000 or more. Two stars, settlement with at least one African-American farmer owning 400 acres or more or worth $4,000 or more. And three stars, settlement with at least one African-American farmer owning 1,000 acres or more or with property worth $10,000 or more. So in all of these settlements, she would indicate that in all of these settlements.
Mm.
So these were number dots on the map. Yeah. So she just had a map. And again, she got the name, and then she got another page. She gives you a name in each of these settlements in each of these states. In Ohio, she got the name for all 300. She got the name for all 338. Farming settlements that black people had in the Northwest Territory between 1800 and 1860. It's a history.
You're right. It is.
You see, because we don't look at self-sufficiency that we were about. The self-sufficiency black people had. Now, did you know this? Did you know at the end of slavery that it was the formerly enslaved black men who were basically the skilled laborers of the United States? These plantations these plantations our folks came off of were like little cities in and of themselves. So blacks didn't just pick the cotton and cut the sugar cane. They were the blacksmiths. They were the carpenters. They were the people that took care of the animals. They were the coopers. The coopers made the barrels that you put the rum in from the sugar. The coopers, that was a skill. Many of my folk, they did these skills on the plantation. So when slavery ended, the fear that white men had, the working white men had, was now they were going to have to compete with these black men for wage labor. And that's why the unions were started. Unions were started basically to keep black people out of these skilled jobs. Now, I talked to you last week about the snow riot. Remember the snow riot in D.C.? Where the white men who worked on the docks got mad because the free blacks who worked on the docks. So when I was coming up in New Orleans, it was black men that did the skilled trades, all in my family. They were the plasterers, bricklayers, all of that, you see. And don't forget, when Booker T was building Tuskegee, it was the blacks that built the buildings, the original buildings at Tuskegee.
Yeah, absolutely right. The students, the students, that was part of their education. They also made their own bricks and nails.
That's right. Not only did they make their own bricks, they sold the bricks, and white folk was coming from around buying the bricks.
Yeah, white folks were.
So when black people did these settlements, they had the skills to do the infrastructure in the construction of the buildings, you know. And that we don't talk about that too much at all, the fact that we had the skills. When you look to today, we've pretty much been de-skilled. We don't have these skills anymore. So we have other groups like your immigrants, your Spanish-speaking immigrants, have taken that void, and that was all planned. That was all planned because American entrepreneurs or corporations or businesses didn't want to pay fair wages to American workers. So what you keep looking for? Cheap labor. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Cheap labor.
Right.
Cheap labor. And so the skill, this stuff started in the United States back in the 90s, I think, where as a result of NAFTA, a lot of the skilled labor out of Mexico started coming into the United States, going to places like North Carolina, you know, initially Texas and California, but they spread out. And even today, like in New Orleans, we have a large Honduran population. They do all the roofing. They do all the construction. I mean, they're good workers. They don't fool around,
right.
You know. So, but, you know, we don't have that. The schools don't have those programs to get those trades, because one issue I understood was that the union for these trades didn't want that competition of students coming out, going into them jobs. I mean, it's just really crazy stuff been going on.
I'm looking at a map out of the book you recommended.
Yeah.
And, man, I'm blown away by it.
Oh, so you was able to see some? You Google book?
What I did was I went to Kindle, Amazon Kindle, on my phone.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm getting the book, but they had, you know, you can check inside the book, and inside the book they have a map.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, this lady is she's got to be a guest. Thank you's not big enough. In Ohio, they list she has 95 settlements, Indiana 92, mm-hmm. Illinois 56, mm-hmm. Wisconsin 31, Michigan 64. It totaled for 338. What they didn't teach in school.
What you could do is you could just start like looking at her lectures on YouTube, because I came across her on C-SPAN, C-SPAN 3.
Uh-huh.
C-SPAN 3 is a channel where they do nothing but historical stuff, lectures, they show you lectures, conferences that they held, and book discussions. So I came across her on C-SPAN 3, but YouTube got lectures on her. And now, what's interesting about the black people that come from this heritage there, when they speak, they don't have what we know of as a black dialect. they sound just like the white people.
mm-hmm.
You know, but they have these rich legacies and histories of coming from people in these black townships. Yeah. So this is what this shows you, that America, from its inception, has always been so racist that it was automatically understood. Black folk automatically knew, hell, we got to take care of each other. We got to be,
right.
You know, we got to be with ourselves and take care of each other and support each other and have our own communities where we could educate our own children and have our own social societies and organizations and we can advocate. And there's another thing too. They were always advocating for blacks. They were always, like, when you look at this thing about these farm communities, They were always participating in the abolitionist movement. They were taking in runaway slaves and escaped slaves. That was always part of our being, fighting against the reality that whites had established for us. We fought against it. We didn't accept it. We didn't accept it. And so the blacks that would escape from places like Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, they would cross that Ohio River and try to go to these places. You see?
I found your lectures on YouTube.
I'm just saying one thing about your series is that this is what the blog talk thing people, many of us are utilizing it for. We're disseminating information that's not discussed. People don't know about a lot of, most people just don't know these things. They just don't know. And so your trial series probably, what you're doing, probably, there probably ain't nobody, I don't want to say nobody because we don't know who's doing what, but ain't many people doing what you're doing with this series, this type of series. You know,
across anybody. You know, like I said, I don't know what's all out there because there's a lot out there. I haven't run across any. And occasionally, some of my friends that went to HBCUs and said, have you ever heard of this person? Never heard of this town? No, I keep on getting those. But, I thank you so much for the information you shared for the last 2 days with your, man, but this is a pure gold mine here. I didn't know up north. And that's just, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. Man, it was like a gold mine up there. I mean, for the information and this kind of stuff can turn somebody's life around if they would just become aware of it.
Yeah. You're right. Imagine if black children part of their whole educational development from first grade to finishing high school was the knowledge that black people had their own, that they were several black people created their own developments and communities. Imagine how that could affect their consciousness when they choose a profession or a career. See what I'm saying?
Right.
And get together with other blacks to have more of an independent-minded thing as opposed to where we are now. We're going to move into this subdivision. We're going to move into that suburb. And we're going to, I'm moving on up like George Jefferson. As opposed to, shoot, we're going to try to get this tract of land, and we're going to do this here. We're going to get this tract of land, and we're going to do that there. And that has pretty much been killed in the bulk of us.
You made an interesting comment. I want to get you more of your thought on this. Like with the Freedom Georgia Initiative, they put it out there, what they're doing. Now, part of that is you have to market your town to get people that want to live there.
We have to do it. We have a network. African Americans already have a network among themselves where we don't have to go to the corporate media. You have your fraternities and sororities. You have your HBCUs. You have your church denominations, the National Baptist Convention USA, National Baptist Convention of America, the Progressive National Baptist Convention, AME Church, the CME Church, AME Zion, Church of God in Christ. I can go on and on and on. We already have a grapevine. We want to go to the corporate stuff.
Market yourself through the grapevine that already exists.
Yeah, because here go my premise. When you are saying you're going to create something to lift yourself up, white folk are going to be there to mess it up. That's just how it's been. They get a joy out of fucking stuff up for black people. They wouldn't be white people if they didn't do that. They wouldn't be if they did. They just do it. So when you already say you're going to do something to improve yourself, you just set yourself up as a target right there by broadcasting it. You see? And
yeah, because the nail that sticks out always eventually gets hit.
Yeah, yeah. So there's nothing wrong with
a lot of these historic black towns, like the towns that you've mentioned in the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of them, but none of them historically even went on a campaign to let everybody know, hey, we're here.
They didn't have to.
And
I mean, they didn't have to. And here's the point. Black people wanted to be left alone. Are you familiar with maroon communities?
I am.
There's a book.
They had them all throughout the Western Hemisphere.
Well, let's just look at North America for right now, where we are.
Okay.
There's a sister. Right. She's a Senegalese sister who works at the Schomburg. Her name is Sylviane Diouf, D-I-O-U-F. You pronounce that D-I-O with J, J. Sylviane Diouf wrote an excellent book focusing on maroon communities in North America. When I read that book, and her sources were primary source documents. When I read that book, almost every page is as if I was a Hollywood producer, you could make a movie about all of those situations with maroons, where black people went into the swamps and in communities for themselves. When I say went into the swamps, they were growing rice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the black people. It was the black people on the plantations that supported them. So when they needed to get meat, like a cow or a pig, the people on the plantation would kill a pig and dress it, and all they had to do that night is come and pick it up and leave. Oh, the book is fascinating. So the point is, we were doing this stuff. This idea of wanting to be left alone and independent, that was who we were coming from Africa. We didn't want to be slaves. We didn't want to be slaves. So there were black people who, they had two types of maroons. They had those that lived on the periphery of the plantation, meaning they weren't too far from the plantation. And at night, they would come back on the plantation. Look, they might have even had a wife. They might have even had a wife and children still on that plantation. They'll go visit them at night.
Right.
They'll go to the big house and take what they need. And they lived in caves. She talked about caves and how you had these man-made caves in the ground that were created where they decked it out. They have furniture and stuff in there. And then you had another type of maroon. The other type of maroons would live further from the plantation, and they would be deep in the swamp. For example, the Great Dismal Swamp. Have you heard of the Great Dismal Swamp?
No, I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, man, that's the swamp that goes between North Carolina and Virginia. She said they had black people living in the swamp so long they were children, had never seen a white person before. And what happened is they would come out at night. They lived out at night, never in the daytime, that when some of them came out in the daytime, the sun would actually blind them.
Mm.
This had been going on in North America. They were black people, and in Louisiana, New Orleans, where I live, there were swamps. And then they would take these boats and canoes, and they would go from places like New Orleans to Mobile, trading with the Indians. I mean, it's very fascinating because the image we had of slavery initially coming up watching TV or just like we were just some helpless people crying and oh Lord, the little gospel music playing in the movies and all that. We were constantly fighting. They were fighting, and that's very well documented. In fact, what she pointed out was the reason why the Southern whites didn't want it to be known about these maroon communities because they didn't want the rest of the country to know that they didn't have no full control of the black people.
You see, they didn't
have full total control of the black people, so they kind of kept it. They talk about that, but all the documents and from the white people themselves, the law enforcement talked about the term they used was banditti. They didn't use the term maroon in the English speaking. North America as much as they refer to them as banditti. They would do stuff like break other black people. If an enslaved black person was arrested, hell, man, they'd go in gangs and bust the black person out of jail. I mean, her book is fascinating. It's called Slavery's Exiles or something like that. I got the book in my study. But this is with so much information out there, man, and it just upsets me when I hear people talking on these platforms and they're just speaking from complete ignorance. They're not sharing information. They're not sharing what books there are or anything. But my point is the Maroon tradition is in direct connection with black people establishing their own towns because they really want to be away. Think about what they saw, L.A. They saw rape. They saw torture.
Yeah, rape,
they saw murder of their people.
Kinds of stuff.
They didn't want to be around, around these white folks. I mean, think about it. You a man with a daughter, with daughters and a wife. You don't want your daughters around those white men.
Right.
You want to protect them. And most blacks, unfortunately, were left on the plantations and had to work for white people. But there was a percentage of us that said, no, no. And then you talk to a lot of black people whose family owned land in places like Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama. That was one of the pride and joys of a black man to have the land to protect his wife and daughters from those white men. In fact, a relative of mine, his father was from Mississippi. His father was one of 19. Their father had 400 acres of land in Mississippi. He was a farmer. And he said his daddy never let his sisters, never left that farm unless they all went to town together to buy shoes. But those girls stayed on the farm. And they didn't even work for white. He didn't want them to go work in white people's houses because the white men, it was definitely guaranteed that white men was going to attempt to sexually assault the black girls working in these houses. So they saw all this stuff, man. They saw this stuff. They didn't want to be around these white folks. They didn't want to be around them. You know? So, but anyway, that's the information that I wanted to share.
Man, I'm glad. I've been taking notes, and I looked up the Great Dismal Swamp, and right now, as you were speaking, the Great Dismal Swamp Maroons. I know what I'm going to be doing for the rest of the day.
Look, Sylviane Jew, find her lectures on YouTube about that book. Her last name is D-I-O-U-F. Her first name is Sylviane, S-Y-L-V-A-N-N-E.
What's the last name again?
D-I-O-U-F. Her father's was from Senegal. I think her mama was French, but she's from Senegal herself. But she worked at the Schomburg. Very, very nice sister, man. Very nice lady. I talked to her a few times. Met her. She came to New Orleans and gave a lecture or something. But her book is Slavery's Exiles, I think the title. Look for her lectures on that. And this lady, Anna Lisa Cox, who did this book. Look at both. Because what you could do with both of them is take both of their concepts to augment your discussion of black towns and settlements. Because black towns and settlements is a black tradition. That's a black tradition. Black towns and settlements is a black tradition. You see? So we got to redefine this stuff they call it. We got to redefine
There's more than enough evidence, man. I'm discovering stuff I didn't even know. I heard of Maroons before, and I read a little bit about them even in Jamaica, but I didn't know, I'm going to say even how advanced they were.
Look, L.A., you know about the Seminoles, right? What the Seminoles were, right? The word Seminole was not the name of an Indian tribe. The word Seminole come from the Spanish Cimarron. Cimarron means runaway. That's what the English word maroon come out of that word Cimarron. What the Seminoles in Florida were, they were a branch of Creek Indians who split from another branch in Georgia and runaway Africans from Georgia and South Carolina who lived together. And they had you had a black settlement along with the Native Americans. And them people grew rice. They got eyewitness accounts of these white folk trying to go in and get these blacks, and they wrote in detail what they saw. They saw these big houses the blacks had built. They saw rice fields. And do you know the U.S., right. The United States government, they say this is the first Vietnam. They did not defeat the indigenous and the and formerly enslaved blacks. They did not defeat them. They agreed to a treaty with the U.S. government to leave and relocate. But the plantation owners in South Carolina.
Yes. You're qualified to teach a course on this topic on a university level because you're spouting out stuff that I haven't heard come out of a university professor's mouth.
But guess what? The movement you got going on in the country now is to stop all the talk about this and don't bring it up. See, that's what Florida is taking the lead.
Now
you're
talking about with the critical race theory thing.
Well, what they're doing is they're using that word critical race theory as a cover, as a straw man to really go after any discussion that is critical of the narrative that has been provided for everybody to go along with. And so the critical race theory really is like a false alarm just to use like a flashlight. You go in looking for something in the night, and then you hear somebody talking about the Maroons. Critical race theory, get rid of it. Kind of like when you have a colonoscopy, and the doctor is looking for polyps in your colon to kill them on the spot. Well, that's what this critical race theory straw man is. It's to whenever you hear people discussing or talking about or being critical of the American history narrative, kill it on the spot in terms of stomping out the discussion. But anyway, all right, so I'm going to get off here. But, yeah, check out them two authors, Anna Lisa Cox and Sylvia Ann Jew. And it worked.
Yeah, I done found them both. Yeah. I done bookmarked them. We'll find another town for tomorrow. You done gave me a whole bunch in the last 2 days today. Boy.
Oh, and don't forget to try to contact the people on.
One a day.
Yeah, Pennytown. Right. Don't forget their website, pennytownchurch.org. They're having a homecoming in August, and then you could probably contact somebody to be on the guest. They'd probably be more than excited to be on there to get to talk about that.
All right. And I definitely like you're right. There's a bunch of established networks already that people can go through like in the case of Freedom Georgia Initiative. You know, marketed or organizations like that. And and basically be left alone.
Yeah,
because you're right. A lot of these communities, the bottom line is they were formed because they just wanted to be left alone.
They didn't want no white missionary or patriarchy. They wanted to be left alone because, see, they understood. This is my point. They witnessed the dirt that whites, good so-called good whites and bad whites, they have witnessed the treatment of. Because even the good whites had a paternalistic attitude towards blacks. Because you know, when these black colleges were first established, many of them, did you know, the teachers were basically all white, and the presidents of the schools were all white initially.
It wasn't the majority. Isn't the majority, not all, I don't know which ones, but a lot of HBCUs were started by white folks.
No. This is how this goes. Yeah, the land grant schools were a result of the state legislature decisions But you got the fact in that that was during Reconstruction, and you had black politicians in the state legislatures during Reconstruction in these southern states. You see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
So the land grant colleges, not the private colleges, no, because Spelman was, Morehouse was started in the basement of a church. You have to, you kind of have to look at each one separately. But the point is, Howard University was established by through the federal government, and so your teachers and presidents were white. You didn't, Howard University didn't get a first black president until the 1940s. I want to say that was Mordecai Johnson, and he looked like a white man. He looked like man. But what you had going on these college campuses with these white teachers is you had this attitude that, you know, I'm your daddy, I'm your mama. And the blacks resented that. Blacks always hated that kind of mess. And that's why you got the black church today. The black church, what we mean by the black church is these black denominations that were established. We didn't get the black church because white people didn't want us to go to church with them. In fact, during slavery, white people took, the white slave owners took some of their enslaved blacks to church. But black people wanted to have their own space away from these, off from under these white folks' supervision. That's where the black church comes from. We want to be able to express our humanity in a manner that makes us feel free from the supervision of these white folk looking over us and telling us what to believe and think. That's why we sang differently. That's why we prayed differently. Because it was a way of resisting their total control of us. But anyway, I don't want to go further with this. But anyway, I'll tune in tomorrow then.
Okay, thank you, Warren. Well, matter of fact, we're out of time for this. We're going to shut it down.
Okay, then. All right.
Everybody have a good day. See you tomorrow.